catch up with them.
Right, right. All right, we'll begin this smaller meeting of DEEP for April. Start with introductions. I'll start with Mike Odrin, Olson Engineering.
Steve Bacon, Clark Region Wastewater.
Jeff Risman, Montrose.
Eric Lima, SJ Engineering.
John Hardy, Bridger ABM.
Gaither Holmes.
Nicole Snyder, Clark County DES and Community Development.
Greg Schaefer, Clark County Development Engineering.
Diana Knapp, Development Engineering.
Great. Terry's not here.
Terry called just a little while ago, got a hold of Rosie, and I guess his son is in the hospital.
Oh, no.
So, yeah, he's not able to make it.
Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we were going to introduce Terry, but he's not here, so I guess we'll do that next month.
Terry Wallen.
Tyler Wallen, yeah. He's our new member, at-large member, replacing Helen. Just note that we're recording these meetings for placement onto the county's website and to silence your phones, please.
And they are on the website.
And they are now.
Yes.
Oh, they are?
Yes,
right.
They are.
Is your personal contact information on the website, Mike?
hopefully my work contact information is on the website.
I want to know what your home address is.
You can look that up very easily. In fact, why don't you stop by sometime and we'll have a beer.
You know I'm teasing you.
I know.
Home address, favorite hobbies.
Uh-huh.
It's up on your Facebook.
That's true. That's true. If you're friends of mine. Let's see.
Hi.
Yeah.
Right here, it's cozy.
That I wanted to display.
Not today.
So, you pass around your laptop.
Is that for your updates?
It's a presentation I gave to the board in February. The update's not quite ready yet because it's only the 3rd of April. It usually takes us a little while to get all the numbers in.
Okay.
And I wanted to give you an overview of what was presented in February.
Well, do you want to come back in May and present it? Absent printing out everything or us hovering over laptops?
Well, you guys, I'm not until 1:15, right? I can go print some of these stuff.
Oh, okay. Off. That'd be great.
That, and if you have a meeting on May, what?
We are May 1st.
Yeah, I'll be out of town.
Okay.
So I'll go print this stuff off and be right back.
All
right,
Marty. Okay, thanks.
Let's see. Andrew showed up. Let's see. We'll review and adopt the minutes, and I'll entertain a motion.
Mr. Chairman? Just a comment on the minutes, if I may.
Absolutely.
And whatever you think here is best is good by me. I was looking at, on the second page, third paragraph, begins, there were many questions Deeb asked.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those was, what was the payback period? And you could suggest it's implied in just the conversation or the text and tone. But that was one that I was curious about. I wonder what the payback period is.
Was that a question that we asked then?
Yeah.
For the return on investment.
Yeah, it's kind of a return on investment.
Yeah.
And there's different ways to calculate it, but just some kind of calculation.
Okay.
That's just a comment. I don't know if you want to include it in the minutes.
I think that we can amend the minutes in the motion.
I would make that motion then and then move to approve.
Okay. Well, we have a motion to amend first, so I'll take a second on that. Okay. All in favor on the motion to amend?
Aye.
Okay. any abstentions? Noes? Okay, very good. And then I'll take a motion on the approval of the amended.
I'll move.
Okay.
Second.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Very good. Thanks. Yeah, good. And it could be implied by what is listed in here, but one of the most important things that we did ask about. Mm-hmm. Upcoming events.
Upcoming events. We have 3 events in the month of April for the Board of County Commissioners, either work sessions or hearings. The first being a work session, Clark County Historical Museum Annual Update, as you see listed there, Wednesday, April 9th, 10:30 a.m. Following that, a hearing, adoption of land use regulations for marijuana-related facilities. That's on Tuesday, April 15th, 10 a.m. And lastly, for the month of April, a joint public meeting with Planning Commission to discuss the service mining overlay. That's Thursday, April 17th, 6:30. We have in the month of April two sessions or hearings for the Planning Commission. The first is a work session, Stormwater and Comprehensive Plan, Thursday, April 3rd. That's an evening meeting, 5:30 p.m. And then also a joint public meeting with Planning Commission to discuss surface mining overlay again in the evening, Thursday, April 17th, 6:30.
Oh, I see. I was going to say that was out there already, but it's with the board as well as PC. Okay. Anything else from staff?
Steve Stewart's thing at 3 o'clock.
At 3 o'clock today?
That's
why we're here in
yes.
now.
Yes. Right next door.
All right. Let's see. Next thing here is the DEEB work plan. I want to actually skip until the end. Just let's quickly go through any correspondences that we have. And I didn't see any, except for the driveway curb cuts, and that's number four on our item today.
Right, so. Yep.
Okay, so no correspondences. Any DEEB member announcements? Seeing none. Let's go back up to the DEEB work plan for 2014 and 15. It says 15 and 16, but I think it's more 2014 and 15. This is included in your packet. I've gone through and I redlined. You should have received a redlined copy of this in the email with the 2012 full work plan on it struck. These are my and Greg's comments in here. And we need to meet with the board, I think, in May to update them. I think we've done it in April in the past, but sometimes it's slid till May. And I know that Eric has commented on a couple of items that he feels are a higher priority to review. Plat alterations is one of them. And Eric, why don't you just give us a quick background on what that means? That's on page, well, it says 6 of 4, so I don't know what that means. about two-thirds of the way down the page, so look at in 2014.
Yes, it's kind of an ongoing item, and plat alterations, right now it's a one-size-fits-all approach, and there's a lot of different variations. There's situations where there's a typo on a plat, and it has to go through pretty much a $10,000 process to fix the typo. So looking at different levels of plat alteration, there are some that really are a significant alteration. You're reconfiguring lots. It's really set up more for a plat alteration like that, not a correction or an update. There's been several situations where county staff has done declarations to amend, but it's not like a formal. It's not a formal policy. It's something that staff has done and they've worked out through the PC's office on how to do it. But none of that's in code, and it's not really a. It's something that we can look at and reform.
I've been through that process before. It worked out pretty well as yeah. opposed to, yeah.
And Marty's very familiar with this. I know it's something that's a staff.
What am I familiar with?
Plat alteration processes.
Yeah.
And, yeah. yeah. It's frustrating on both
Just
sides.
Don't make any mistakes, and you won't need to do a plat alteration.
Okay. Yeah.
Second one, our deep work plan.
Right.
Eric brought up.
Okay. As we're going through this, are there any ideas about what other options might be as far as different levels or codifying the declaration process? Or
you know, it's similar to what we did with the tenant improvements, right? That process was a one-size-fits-all.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you know, even if it was a move-in, you went through the same checklist as he did if it was a full reconstruction, and there wasn't really levels of intensive. So now doing something like that similar with the plat off, finding a way to codify the process so it can be done right, mm-hmm. but at different levels depending on the size of the modification or the alteration.
Okay.
I'm trying to make it easier on staff.
The problem with plat alts is some of it's derived from the statute,
mm-hmm.
and it's pretty, you know, Chris Horn gets a little protective that we follow the RCW. So
verbatim.
To the extent that
yeah.
to the extent that we can simplify a plat alt process, we will do so, but keep in mind that we have to be consistent with what the state law says.
I've recently gone through one in another jurisdiction, and they don't even have anything codified in their own code.
Yeah.
It talks about it. They have to fall back to the to RCW 5717, and there's not a, I mean, that's not even very clear in and of itself.
Yeah.
It's not very well written, so we can certainly, I guess, request of staff they could take a look at it.
And I think we need to include Chris Horn, because okay. You know, there's been those declaration to amend mm-hmm. as well, but that's not codified, and they're not ideal. There's probably a better way to do it.
Okay.
And trying to visit that and find out something to make it easier on staff as well. Because
mm-hmm.
every time they come up, and unfortunately it'd be great if no one ever made any mistakes, but it happens. You know.
We're all seasoned.
Except, yeah.
No, we're all seasoned here. We should be
yeah.
making mistakes, right?
Very good.
I will say though, on the plat alt, it's just not whether we simplify it or not. It's what we charge. I'm going through one right now, and it's
yes.
very simple.
Exactly.
And it's like, if it's a very simple plat alt, even if we provide notice, you know, should we be charging whatever we charge?
Right.
So we can look at that as well.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah.
So how do we? So we're agreeing we're going to do this.
Mm-hmm.
We put it on the work plan.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll prioritize.
Yes, that's exactly what the intent here is, to just introduce those new items to the board on the work plan. And then what I would request of everyone is to go back after this meeting today, or we can follow up after at the end of the meeting if we have time left over. And kind of prioritize, maybe send out your own thoughts about everything here, and then we can, at our next meeting, we can follow up with not only the board, but then our next meeting prioritize maybe request of staff for them to take a look at what they can as far as these work items on the work plan are concerned. That was the first item for 2014. You can review the other comments in red as we kind of roll through here, but everything earlier than the plat alt process has already been included on our previous work plans. Some of the items are being updated to us, like the comprehensive plan and the concurrency updates. Stormwater, I think we have a technical advisory going on that presently, Eric?
Yes.
Okay. So, in fact, that might be something that we might look to you guys to give us an update on, you know, here within the next couple of months.
Here's Ron.
Yeah. I saw him come in. And there's a lot involved in that. That's going to likely take some time.
Okay.
And I think...
Are we premature now?
And we're probably... We have a draft. Is everything... Do we have a full draft at this point?
We'll have a review draft next week, and then we'll start a one-month comment period, kind of go pencils down for a month, make comments. We're still on track to submit to Ecology in June.
So
maybe that would be a good
during time. That month, I would say next month, we need to make that a priority. We might need some additional help from this group.
Okay.
So it tends to be, I don't know, would you say you've received a lot of comments from the work groups? I mean, there's some, but it tends to be the same people.
Apple is June.
You know,
May.
There's probably like three
May,
or four people.
May we have
that really
May.
Commented.
Okay.
And we need more participation than that.
One presentation.
There's some other people in this room who have that experience to chime in as well.
Well, can you then present, give us an update in May then? Would that be an appropriate time to do that?
Yeah, we're going to do a work session with the board in mid-May.
Okay.
And let them know what we heard from the public and where we're at in the process. But anytime you guys want input.
And then maybe that would be a good time for us to include our input, too.
Yeah, so our next meeting is in May. Maybe that's... Yeah.
Actually, even May 1st.
So. May 1st.
Yeah.
So we'll be ready May 1st to do...
I don't think you have to be completely ready. I think that we're just kind of looking at an overall update as far as what the proposed changes are, more a 5,000-foot view rather than all the details.
Here's what I'm thinking. If we can get it on our agenda for May 1st, so mm-hmm. we kind of go over some of the big items, and then from this group, we have a subcommittee, and we need to submit formal comments by
June.
Before that, really, right?
Well, it would be ideal for us if it happened during the comment period.
Which is May.
I think it ends May around the first end of the first week in May. I don't know off the top of my head.
That's going to be challenging.
Well,
but we can try.
I don't think you have an alternative.
No. Yeah. I mean, we've been commenting. I've been commenting throughout.
We've received a lot of input from our technical advisory group members in here that are on that. You know, maybe June might be a good time if people can do comments individually, or if Dee wants to weigh in during the comment period, that would be good. A good time to come back and say, this is it, and these are the comments we heard, would be June 1st, because we're going to submit it June 30th.
Okay. Well, can we split it into two? I mean, sure. Give us an update, kind of brief update in May, and then
meeting.
One more in June?
Yeah, and then we have to have our comments shortly after.
Okay. So good, that'll work.
That's good.
Okay, great.
Can I ask a question, Mike?
Yeah.
So on this process, one of the things that's been frustrating me is, I know there's comment periods, but we're dealing with the State Department of Ecology, mm-hmm. right? Frankly, they don't care about a lot of stuff. This is where it's going to go,
right.
regardless mm-hmm. of the other information they receive. So I'd like to focus our efforts on what we can change, what we can influence, maybe mm-hmm. is a better word. And what's done is done, mm-hmm. and what we can't affect, we can't affect.
No, that's it. And that's
we
a good
have
point.
Done that with the comments so far. We really have been focusing on, you know, key items that we have influence.
That we
on.
Can influence.
Yeah.
That we can impact.
Yeah.
Okay. And we have an audience.
And additionally, it's more informational, too. For those of us who are on the board who, you know, work in the industry, we can disseminate that information to our colleagues and co-workers and things like that, too. So I think that there's a kind of a dual duty here, is that not only do we it provides us an opportunity to comment, but it also provides us a way to get education about this.
That's
too.
Well said. Yeah.
Second item on the list is permit center wait times and appointments. I have some thoughts about that, having experienced a couple things, or experiencing some longer than usual wait times. Hoping that is maybe just the nature of the new process that's going on in there.
That was a test for you.
I was in the day before the grand opening, and yeah, the waits are still long. And I spoke with Marty briefly about it, and I'm sure that's at one of the top of his list too. So now I'm just going to quickly go through these real quick. The construction of site improvements and use of the site prior to building permit submittal issuance. And I'd also like to have another item next to that would be a certificate of occupancy. I just found out today that, yes, you can go ahead and start site work before getting the building permit issued. But what we've run into is being able to use the site before you get a certificate of occupancy on the building itself. And we've had that was a special circumstance that we ran into, but we'd like to see if there's an opportunity to make it not a special.
What do you mean, use of the site?
Use of the site. Well, it was our understanding, and this is we're really talking about KWRL, where they couldn't actually use the site for the storage of the school buses until the building had a certificate of occupancy, and the building lagged behind in construction of the rest of the site improvements. We had to kind of jump through several hoops to get the approval to be able to use the site without the building there.
As in parking buses?
Parking buses. And this is mainly, I would think, in more of an industrial, light industrial situation where you have lay down areas, outdoor storage, things like that that you want to use before any sort of building is built, either, you know, whether that's part of that current phase or in a future phase. It's come up, and I'd rather it be simpler to go ahead and use that. For instance, if even in a commercial situation, they can use the parking lot for adjacent parking or whatever before the building is actually built. So that's something that I wanted to kind of bring up here, see if it's even a priority. But it did come up and was a situation that, you know, did cause a bit of a delay and a little bit of heartburn for the transportation cooperative that we were working for. That they thought they would be able to use the site on a certain date, and we found out that we couldn't necessarily use it. They couldn't use it until they had a certificate of occupancy, at least a temp CFO on the building itself. So that's what that's about. And it really came down to having facilities, restroom facilities for the PCOs
and workers.
Yeah, so and that was, you know, a porta potty, ADA accessible porta potty, and that took care of it. So it was pretty simple in the end. The driveway spacing, road modifications. Again, these are all items that I kind of come up with, and I'm really looking to the rest of the board to provide anything that they might feel is important for us to look at over the next year. This is what it really comes down to, is the always approved driveway spacing road modification. Even staff agrees that it's always approved. I would challenge them to, if there have ever been any denied,
whether it be existing access, a road modification to maintain existing access to road modification, or for a new one where there is no other access available, but you still have to go through a road modification process.
Yeah, we did talk about it, and Ollie's not here, but for what his comment was in those situations, because there's a potential safety thing there, they always approve them, but it was documentation in case there's an accident someone pulling out of the driveway. It was documented that, you know, it was substandard, but we had to give them access. So it was more to cover their liability.
And
I don't know that there was not a different way to do that, but I'm just referring, I would like to not have to do the road mods as
well.
But I'm just, since Ollie's not here, that's what he said.
And maybe there's a form for that, so that, you know, we don't have to have a traffic engineer or a PE write the road mod and take the time to do that, just in the benefit of our clients. And if that's the case, and if they need to have it done, that's fine, but maybe there's a simpler way of doing it.
Yeah.
There is a point to that, in the sense, we had a subdivision that was fully approved, built, constructing houses, and I had to get a road mod to put a driveway in for a corner lot.
Yeah.
And it just didn't seem like we were past that point. Maybe that's kind of piggybacking what you're talking about.
So one thing we did do, though, on the last biannuals is we clarified that, so that we changed the code for corner lot driveways. So they are allowed, and there's a size limitation. It's mm-hmm. 20 feet. I would like to see larger, but step 1 to 10. So.
Right, and 5 feet from the property line or something like that.
Yeah, or shared.
Does this issue get into the court easements at all?
The what?
Are they the court easements or are they the
cords are different. That's on the intersection.
That's at the intersection to a collector and arterial.
Yeah. Well, and within a subdivision, though, they're also within corner lots that line.
Shouldn't be.
Are you talking the site distance at the corners at uncontrolled intersections?
Is it?
But on a collector or arterial.
Collector or arterial.
So what we just did is within the interior subdivision, almost every corner lot has, and I thought it was called a cord, but maybe not.
It's a radius cord that, instead of having a radius to the right of way, you have a radius cord where you take off.
Does it affect your envelopes?
Big time.
That's a vision clearance triangle.
It must be a vision clearance.
And that
on small interior roads in a subdivision?
Yeah, and that's one of those things that you could put in a stop sign instead and you wouldn't have that, but it's at uncontrolled intersections that you have the vision clearance.
Intersections are just
vision clearance and sight.
I thought that was on 152nd, though, not on your interior local.
No, it's on interior, all through it. I'll show it to you and then see whether it's on.
Yeah.
I apologize. I'm here. You reminded me.
And then the last one were the fall biannuals. If anybody has anything that they feel should be on the fall biannuals, you mentioned there are a couple out in the spring, so we're just going to delay them.
Well, we've got Jan busy on project review.
Right. Yep.
Yeah.
Would you rather have him work on legislative?
No, I just wanted to identify this for the fall.
Yeah,
not the spring.
get them on, and we'll. Actually, some of our spring and fall biennials have kind of like gone really winter summer.
Okay.
So if we go with a true fall biennial, we'll get them on early and start the process. And probably.
And how many items do you have on there right
August
now?
August or September? I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know if Jan's keeping a
running list.
Yeah, running list or not.
Okay.
Usually there are a number that are drummed up through all the time that we work on these things.
Sure.
We always come up with a list, and you guys can add to it, modify it, what have you.
Good. So, and then I get, again, for the work plan, provide any comments to Greg and I that you might want to see, any items on here, as well as for the fall biannuals, any proposed code changes that we can discuss as we kind of move towards that too. So,
Mike, real quick question to clarify. So this first cycle through on me, but talking with Rosie, I guess at least sometimes in times past, Deeb has done like a retreat, you know, around the work plan. I don't know if in this case, you know, when we went out by email, we're getting input back already covering our meeting, if you think that's necessary, or maybe we're a little bit time constrained for that anyway. So,
and I would open that up to the board. In the past, we have had a retreat. We have a lot more on the docket and the agenda at those times. I don't know if we have that level now. I mean, you take a look at everything that we've had on here versus what we have on here now for just this part. Everything is kind of ongoing that were the hot topic items. I might look to Eric to provide some a little bit of guidance as far as that's concerned, since he's kind of the senior member here, and whether or not there's even a need for a deed retreat like we've done in the past.
You know, I think it's up to the group. We've done it before to go through it. We kind of do what we're doing right here.
Though. Yeah. Yeah, and this is just maybe a shortened Cliff Notes version of doing that.
I would be fine with skipping it this year unless everyone else wants to do it. But we go through, we brainstorm ideas, mm-hmm. We go through our priority list. That's what we've done in the past.
And I think people are just kind of giving us their ideas as things come up.
Yeah.
One more efficient. I'm with you. I don't see the big need to have a retreat this year, unless there's something big that anybody can think of. These were the big kind of policy items that we were talking about previously. Staffs addressed them or they're ongoing. So.
Right. We could do it like every other year as needed.
There we go.
I really feel like we need it. The market's changed a little bit.
It has.
We're a little more reactive right now.
Mm-hmm.
We're all getting busier, staff's busier. We're not working on as many of these little side projects as we do. Like, staff has some big ones, like Tidemark and technology things.
Right.
I'm okay with skipping it this year if everyone else is.
Okay.
And then as far as the work session with the board, mm-hmm. do you want me to go ahead and schedule that? Do you want to wait until our May meeting and kind of see where we're at then? Or
why don't you schedule it for mid-May now,
okay.
and then we can prepare for it at our May meeting.
Okay.
In the meantime, we can kind of put together. And if you could ask Rosie, because I know that we had the 2012 work plan that came with this document, if she could find the 2013.
Okay.
And send that along also if she happens to have it.
All right.
Would be helpful to me. And then I'll just touch base with Helen as far as getting a presentation ready. She mentioned that she'd help me with that to the board.
Okay. Excellent.
And then in the meantime, we can prioritize. I'll get some priorities together for this and then maybe some questions. Condense this a little bit, maybe take off what we don't need. And then come up with an overall work plan that's a little cleaner.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But if over the next week, if the board members could comment on this, I'd appreciate it.
All right.
Anything else on that?
We had a parking lot.
Oh, we did. These are the same parking lot items.
Maybe you should move to the work plan, actually. And the last one, which was the erosion control piece, that's been on kind of our work plan for a while when those
first
came out.
Yes.
And those are fairly significant. I think we at least need to talk to Environmental Services about the erosion control piece. I know the DOE has required them, but mm-hmm. there was a small job that we had. The fees, and I'm going a little bit off memory, so it's probably not exact, but previously, before we had the erosion control, the fees were about $4,000 mm-hmm. for inspection. After the erosion control went in with the bonding and everything, the inspection fees were $12,000, and the work from the contractor was about $8,000. So there's a little bit off on how those erosion control fees are calculated.
Does that include the CECL work?
No, well, that's just the county's portion. Then you still have to get your NPDES, and you still have to pay your CECL. Mm-hmm. So the erosion control stuff's getting triplicate. Applicants are paying it three times right now. There's a lot of layers.
Yeah, just a quick, if I can, a clarifying comment. We don't set the erosion control fees. Those are done by Public Works. They do the inspection. So if you want to talk about how the fees are calculated and whether they're appropriate, and I agree they need to be looked at, we can participate in the discussion, but it's not. We didn't set them.
Okay.
Yeah. They're in there.
Well, then I imagine your email is going to come out with one of those as one of your top priorities.
I commented.
Yeah, thank you for doing that. I appreciate that.
We would concur. Huge.
But
these do need to be looked at.
Okay, good. Right, if that's it, then sorry we're a little late, Marty, but if you want to give us your update.
I have one thing as I pass this out. Mentioned one of our larger projects we're working on is to replace our aged Tidemark system, which has been around since 1999. I think I gave you guys a status report. We had an RFP out late 2012. We spent most of last year winnowing down two vendors that at the end of the day, I wasn't willing to spend the kind of money to see incremental improvements.
Mm-hmm.
Suffice it to say that the two vendors, the two final vendors, would be perfect for if we're going on a brand new system. We've never been on an electronic system before. Or if we're a county of 80,000, 100,000. So we're just more mature than that. We officially rejected the RFP and revisited the sections of our RFP since we learned so much last year on what it is that we're really after. We rewrote the RFP, sent that out, and proposals were due back yesterday. We did some kind of pre-screening of vendors, about eight of them, and I sat through seven kind of web demonstrations, and they're all much better systems and more in keeping with what I have in mind. Proposals were due yesterday. We got three back.
How many went out?
We had like 13 or 15 on our plan holder list. One of the three is one from last time around. One of the three is our current vendor, parent company to our current vendor, and one is new. So there's an evaluation process that we're going to be going through. We will do at some point in the next probably couple months an on-site demo with probably the top two of the three, and we'll move forward from there. So just I'll keep you guys all up to speed on that.
Did you guys check with the city to see how theirs is going?
Yes, we've had our staff in constant contact with them, and we were on the system together.
Yeah.
And they moved to Hanson, and we didn't, and they didn't even submit. So we've learned in talking to them, and we've learned from the RFP last year what to look out for.
Okay.
Implementation. There's several things to be concerned about in implementation. Fortunately, we have a project manager out of the IT group that is going to write a very, very tight scope of work and a contract with some kind of stiff penalties for non-performance. So we're ahead of the game on that.
Good. Okay.
For anybody who tracked a work session presentation I was at in early February, this was in front of the Board of County Commissioners following Mark Gassaway, who does a quarterly financial report to the board. And I'm just going to, I'd hope to have this on a thing here. I presented this information in the morning and found out that I forgot something to add. And so the very first thing you'll see is an author's note here. I had to amend a few slides because I forgot to add some of the traffic impact fees that were waived. So I'm going to go to this first slide three. You know, I wanted to cover the revenue model and how we apply it. And we use as kind of examples two tenant improvements, one addition, and two new construction projects. So, you know, tenant improvements were, one was large, one was small. New construction, large and small. We did not cover, you know, and this has been consistent all along. This is not an exercise of proving causation or disproving causation or correlation of the fees and how the projects are moving forward. We're not asking, you know, if the fees for a particular project are not waived, would the project have gone ahead anyway? And actually, this second bullet point on what is the marginal revenue increase, we're trying to actually get at that now because there's a, from, since this work session in February, we've put together a way to estimate sales tax revenue. And Jeff Swanson, who's the railroad guy and the presumptive
economic development manager now that Kelly Sills is gone. I think he's going to take this over. He has an economist. He's an economist. He has an economics background, and he can kind of take and run with this. We did not report the impact of the some number of employees that are going to be hired for projects. So main sources of revenue we're looking at are the property tax revenues and sales tax. On the property tax side, there's an initial increase. So you go from bare dirt with $0 of improved value to Chuck's Produce, which has some whatever that number is. There's also the annual ongoing levy assessments from the general fund and the road fund. Sales tax, we got the one time from new construction, so when you're building new structures, new buildings, the sales tax from all that construction material and labor, sizable projects can be tracked. And then this annual ongoing sales tax is something that the board's keenly interested in. There are some assumptions on the projects that they actually come to fruition, and actually, you know, we have some that are dropping out. But to date, meaning we haven't rolled all of March's numbers yet, but up through February, we had 76 projects since June 2013. And a couple of them are dropping off.
I'm sorry, 76 projects that indicated an interest?
76 projects that we've waived fees on.
Okay.
There are a couple other assumptions that either immediately or within 2 years of occupancy, the employee counts that they've reported will come to pass. And then small tenant improvements and additions are not charged traffic impact fees because they were assessed initially. Revenue assumptions, we have a five-year window from this year through 2014. We have different timing windows for tenant improvements and additions and new construction. Like new construction, going from site plan review to new construction could be 2 years. For a tenant improvement, heck, you can be done in 3 months. So small tenant improvement. And then the tenant improvements and new construction, there are different values and there are different potential revenue impacts. We just finished up the remodel of the permit center. That would be considered a tenant improvement. That's not going to move the needle of the assessed valuation of this building. It just won't do it. But if we add it, of course.
Your new suite will.
Yeah. there were some revenue assumptions that we worked with the budget office, this gal Adriana Prada. She does a lot of forecasting. For the budget office and the board. She took some estimates from county data, the taxable retail sales and the assessed valuation per square foot of development. So in a model that the budget office has built on the sales tax piece, which is completely different from what Jeff Swanson is going to do, there was an assumption that you're going to generate $55 per square foot of taxable retail sales. And we know that on an individual project-by-project basis, that's not going to hold true. An example, a church of 30,000 square feet is not going to generate $55 per of that 30,000 square feet. But some other project where we're saying it's 55, and it's much more than that. So the revenue model is a statistical model, and it has to be looked at in the aggregate. There is a cost of construction per square foot by the type of development, and that's a solid number from the assessor's office. They value, they assess the value based on the type of construction and development. Projected growth rates for assessed value and retail sales, we project some growth rate for those particular sales, and then there's no major annexation activity that we assume. Like Vancouver's not going to annex all of Salmon Creek. So we took some examples, okay? We had this Therapeutic Associates, 1,860 square feet, The value of construction was $89,000. The applicant reports 2 new jobs and $600,000 in annual sales. So the application fees were $4,400 and the traffic impact fees were zero because it was a tenant improvement. And you'll see that the taxable retail sales, one-time construction sales, is and then potential all revenue is $6,481. Again, some of these won't move the needle on property tax. The next one, sorry, Marty.
Yes. Stop you there, just so that we get an idea going forward what this all means.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking at a net gain of $2,000 then
on this project.
On this project.
What's the county share of the retail sales? Is this the county share?
1.2%.
I'm sorry. Does that number reflect the county share?
It reflects 5 years of the county share. The state sales tax is 6.5%.
Yeah.
County sales tax share, the local share, is 1.2%.
Okay, this is the five-year projection of the county's
1.2%.
Correct.
Perfect. And the 1.2% is broken out. This what will be reported from a point soon forward is the local share of the sales tax is 1.2%. Half of that, so 0.6%, is general fund. Just non-dedicated general fund. And then the other 0.6 goes to, you know, there's 0.2 that goes to they call it a meth tax, so for alcohol and chemical dependency. 2%, you know, 0.2% goes to law and justice, and, you know, there's a breakout. But in total, it's 1.2%. The next one is this D&D Doors. It's a larger project, 11,000 square feet. Roughly 320,000. This is a project that actually moved from Portland over to Salmon Creek. So the $3 million in sales is all net new. So you'll see that the fees waived is, you know, $7,600 and $4,700 in traffic impact fees. And then the taxable sales, because it's all net new, is a fairly decent chunk of change, $35,000. Mm-hmm. One time $6,600 and then property tax. So this is a net win.
That project, they're moving over here, didn't have anything to do with the
program. They moved, and you know, they didn't, to my knowledge, they didn't make their decision to move here based on this program. They moved in and kind of found out after the fact that I kind of figured out that, hey, this is exactly what we were after, moving businesses into Clark County. The next one was just an addition, an additional 3,100 square feet per shop, you know, probably fairly simple construction at 67,000, four new jobs, 350 in sales. So we waived application fees, no traffic impact fees, and then you'll see that this is, you know, waiving 2,900 and getting 12 back. So this is where we get to the new construction. This is a Highway 99 car wash, 3,200 square feet. We didn't have the value of construction because they haven't built it yet, but they got, you know, 6 jobs and 750,000 annual sales. So we waived, you know, 26,000 in application fees, but because it's new, it's 103 in traffic impact fees. And I've been quoted that traffic impact fees are the more challenging fees to overcome.
Were you quoted correctly?
Yes. You'll see that, you know, we're going to get maybe 8,200 in retail sales. Again, this number may change based on a different model, a different methodology. Our sales, one-time construction sales, and then ongoing property. Cold Creek Industrial, the next one. Larger project, 27,000 square feet, $2.25 million is the value of the construction. So you'll see that, you know, the fees waived is about $90,000 total. You know, the taxable sales is pretty sizable. The one time is pretty sizable, and then our property tax is on a $2.25 million valuation, is about around 12,000. So this is kind of a net gain. I wanted to give the board a little perspective going, you know, back from year 2000 to now. You know, how has our building valuations, how's our permit volumes been? And 2004 and 5, you'll see the green anomalies. 2004, that was Salmon Creek, what Legacy Hospital.
Oh.
And 2005, that was I think buildings at Washington State University. So two large. So you'll see that actually, you know, we've seen a pickup, you know, in the you know, fourth quarter of 2012 and 13. Pretty good.
Was so 2010, that was the biggest year?
2005, I think, was Wazoo. There's a couple projects.
2010 first quarter.
Well,
2010 first quarter.
First quarter. 2010. There's a big one there. What's that?
Your new place.
Yeah.
I'd have to look. That's a good question. Well, we had some work with PacifiCorp, Yale. I think that's not that early, 2010. I could look here. So here's kind of where we're at. You know, second, third quarters of the third, fourth quarters of descent of 2013. So last half of 2013, we waived 366,000 traffic impact fees, which some of them were waived, but many of them are to be waived. When you see a report, it's to be waived because it's
time. You've included already waived and committed.
So, you know, the total fee is about 1.63, and we're going to get about $1.25 million back. The applicants do report 359 new jobs and 127 million annual sales. I think once Jeff takes this. New methodology and with accurate and consistent data from the applicants estimating sales tax revenues, it could be a different story. So kind of the takeaways, larger tenant improvements seem to be net gains. I think it has to do, with the traffic impact fee. Depending on the TIFs and the annual tax potential revenue for new construction is mixed. And then this was, the model that if you look at some of these individually, there was a pharmacy that showed $26 million in sales. That's not taxable. We know that from Department of Revenue. So whether you use $55 a square foot or 1.2%, that $26 million, we won't see the sales tax revenue. And then, you know, TIFs have the most significant impact on the return on investment, if you will. So that's what was presented in February. Shortly after this February 5th work session, I had a meeting with the board on can we come up with a different methodology of estimating sales tax revenue. Property tax revenue is pretty solid. I mean, the assessor has all of this data, all of this information, and property tax improvements come out every 6 months, and 12 months, and 18 months. So that's a very those numbers are easy to get at. There aren't nearly as many assumptions built in, so on and so forth. So we're trying to look at what is the sales tax piece to this, we were doing some work, and I think it'll be Jeff Swanson kind of taking that over. I can ask Jeff to report out like in maybe June or something like that as he gets his arms around this.
Oh, that'd be good. Looks to me one of the questions that we had at our last meeting was what's the cost per job, and based on looking at the 1.63 with 359 new jobs. Roughly $4,500 per job. But then if we take a look at over the 5 years,
where we're able to recoup the 1.25, that number drops down to just over $1,000 a job. But it takes 5 years to realize that over time. I think that that's one important number that we were originally looking at. What's the subsidy of, what is the county subsidizing? What's the amount per job?
Yeah.
And that's, just based on this information here, I think that's an important number that we were kind of looking for. Is that a reasonable?
Well, those are even skewed, because some of the biggest fees we're waiving are to fueling stations.
With one job.
With maybe two if you have shift workers. So you have two people manning a kiosk at a fueling station, and we're waiving $500,000.
Minimum wage.
So, that's the challenge, whether you're, on the DEEB or whether you're sitting at the Board of County Commissioners. Do you look at this project by project and some evaluation, or do you look at it in aggregate?
Yeah.
And that's why the commissioners, in particular Commissioner Medor, was interested in, this model in aggregate shows one thing, but what about these projects? So we're trying to get at that.
Okay.
Are you open to observations?
Oh, absolutely.
So just like we've excluded, or the commissioners have excluded residential?
Yes.
I would say just the, on its face, the no-brainer is you exclude certain segments. It doesn't make any sense. We don't need more fueling stations that we waive $500,000 and get 1.5 jobs out of. So I think you can target this thing where you could increase your return on investment. Target what you want and maybe make it a win-win.
When this current resolution was in front of the board, there were, I don't know, maybe a dozen or more amendments proposed by the individual board members.
Yeah.
And one was to cap the amount of traffic impact fees we waive. Mm-hmm. The observation then was, when we're waiving a lot of money, are we going to get the return? The observation still is, when we're waiving $500,000, $400,000, what are we going to see in return? That came up again mid-February at a board time meeting.
Yeah.
Hey, if we looked at capping the traffic impact fee to the first $100,000, if you get $100,000 waived up to $100,000, the rest you pay. There are like 9 projects that are over that, so we would save. I'll use a better term. The road fund, which is going to have to make up the difference in lost TIF revenues, the road fund would save about $1.8 million. This one project, Commissioner Medor was interested in this one, the car wash. The impact fee was $103,982. They would be paying $3,982, and we'd waive the $100,000. We have 2 Fred Meyer fueling stations at $450,000, a couple other projects in the $300,000. You get the first $100,000 waived, you make up the difference. So that's been a conversation. And to date, no changes have been made to the resolution and the parameters.
Jeff?
Yeah, I was just going to say just real quick, and it's I think kind of adding on to what Ott's getting at, and I was thinking that was one of the things that came to my mind was capping TIF or figuring out something with TIF, but then what really comes to my mind is that we're trying to do a one-size-fits-all, and it doesn't fit all, and that's what it seems like the county ought to take. One idea would be the county ought to take an approach like a business and develop what do they want in return on investment, develop a pro forma, and then have the businesses come in and say, I mean, you've got the data, or at least you've got the data they're using now that the businesses should be able to give, and you should be able to kind of track to say, does this meet our return on investment, or what do we need to adjust to make it meet our return on investment, or does it not meet our return on investment? And just, establish some kind of it's not that complicated. You've only had 76 of them, and I don't think it would be that complicated to come up with something that says, here's what the return on investment within 5 years that we're looking for, and if you meet it, great. If not, maybe we adjust TIF, or maybe you just don't meet it and you're not in the program.
I don't think they've been looking for a return on investment. They've been looking for to bring
jobs.
Yeah. It's jobs.
I think, in my mind anyway, the two would work together.
Sure.
Because if the return on investment would equal jobs, would equal tax revenues and things like that. I would think the two would work together. I mean, I'm just spitballing. I think there's a way to approach this almost from a partnership perspective.
Jeff Swanson, I don't know if anybody has met Jeff. Has anybody met Jeff? Well, Jeff's been with the county since, I don't know, July or August of last year. Real sharp guy. He came from, I believe he came from Schnitzer Steel, and he's an economist and very bright guy, and he's going to be looking at these same kinds of questions and issues. Is there a way when we look at this and we get good data, I've always said accurate and consistent data, is there a way to look at this and tweak it to get what you're really after? That's a question for the board, too. If they're just after jobs, and I was in a meeting last week with the board, and it fairly quickly went to, well, we're not measuring the impact of the 430 jobs we're going to see. Well, that's true. I'm not going to do that. I don't think we have the expertise to do that. So it's, stay tuned. If you feel inclined to talk to the commissioners about this, they have an open door policy. Maybe, I wouldn't say May, but June, maybe we could see if Jeff could come to the DEEB and mm-hmm. just say, okay, yep. You've had this now for a couple months. What's your experience?
That sounds great. Yeah. We'll invite him.
This is excellent. Thank you.
Well, this was on the grid.
Uh-huh.
And then we have, Susan Ellinger has been the one compiling all this in a spreadsheet. So we're gonna kind of turn this over to Jeff, and he's gonna do the sales tax piece, and it'll get rolled out again.
Can you explain to everyone what the grid is? I don't know if everyone here knows what that is.
So if you go to the county website, whether you're on the commissioner's homepage or the county homepage, bottom right there are these buttons. There's a transparency piece. There's the grid, and if you go to the grid, it has all the board's hearings, work sessions, and board time agendas. Board time, I don't know how long ago, but board time has been audio taped, so you can listen to board time discussions. When we have work sessions and hearings, and we have materials,
it's all posted.
They're all posted.
Good.
So this is posted. Anyway.
Great, thank you.
Really good work, Marty.
Appreciate it. Yeah.
Thank you, Marty.
Next on the agenda, we're about 15 minutes behind schedule, but we had an extra 15 minutes built in, so I think we're doing okay. Next will be Steve, and Heidi Rasmussen is here also from Rosenberg. My apologies. From the sewer district to discuss their capital facilities plan.
Okay. I brought Heidi. Heidi is the sewer district's capital program manager. I was actually hoping that she would be able to do the presentation, but she went to San Diego and came back without a voice. So I think we can probably save you some of that 15 minutes.
Okay.
Quick, brief overview of the district as a whole. For those who are not real familiar, if there are any, the district is just a special purpose sewer agency. All we do is sanitary sewer. About 500 miles of pipelines, 65 pump stations in our current facilities. And we do, as part of the GMA process, we do a 20-year capital facilities plan, same timing as the county. So whenever the county updates theirs, we update ours. But we also put together a six-year kind of look forward, so we have a tighter capital plan on the six-year horizon. So the further you get on that 6 year, it's a rolling 6 years, so the further you get out, the less surety there is that the project is actually going to happen. Years 1 and 2 are pretty well set. 3 gets a little fuzzier. And as you get out to 6, it's, well, we think that's what's going to happen. But and our capital program is actually, it's set up to take care of both the capital expansion needs, the repair and replacement needs, and we even have like fleet and facilities type items in our capital plan to for campus improvements and stuff like that. We allot some funds for just local going into a subdivision that doesn't have sewer yet and putting in sewers in those as well. So the different documents in the thing, one of them is just, it's a matrix of all the different program pieces that are in it. It's the, what is it, 4-page spreadsheet that gives it an overview of, you know, what we're doing in the 6-year period and where in that period those are likely to fall. So a lot of these, like you'll see that, you know, one of them is a capital facilities projects, which has, you know, pump stations and sewer line extensions. The district installed infrastructure, that those generally get driven by things like county road projects or overlay projects, where we're trying to get in ahead of a road improvement. So that is one that will change on an annual basis as the county puts out their list of road improvements. We will fund dollars on an annual basis to cover those types of things. Septic elimination program is just, it's a, that's one of those where the district goes in neighborhoods, and we just allot a certain amount every year for that. Developer reimbursements, we partner with development, so when we see developments coming in an area where we need a trunk line or a pump station or something like that, we partner with the developers to get them installed at the time the developments are coming in, so we don't have to stick money in the ground and wait for somebody to come build near it. And let's see, it's, the next page is all restoration and replacement, broken out into different programs. With 500 miles of pipe, we have to replace it on occasion, and we also sometimes try to tie those projects in with road projects and stuff like that if we've got areas that we know are going to have to get taken care of. So. And then the back page is, it's more of the capital improvement, but it's geared towards Ridgefield. Taking over the Ridgefield area sewer service at the first of the year, we also took on the responsibility to get their, you know, their capital infrastructure built, and we have over the next 6 years we have a significant amount of investment going in up in the Ridgefield area just because of the economic development potential up there. So we've got, you know, on the first page we actually have, you know, the DCWTS, which is that's kind of the signature project for the next couple of years, where we're going to be connecting the city of Ridgefield into the district for sewer capacity, and eventually we'll abandon their treatment plant and the entire city will flow down into the district.
So you're reversing course? Is that what?
Hmm?
It flows this way?
Yes.
So you're going to do a Chicago River and pump that?
It's all pumped.
But it has to be pumped, of course.
It's all pumped. But yeah, the Lake River just isn't a real great place to discharge from a treatment plant, so it makes more sense to actually turn the treatment plant into a big pump station and send it all back.
Well, where's the Seven Creek one discharged to?
Columbia.
Oh, it goes directly there.
Even though it says Lake River underneath. Right below it.
It yeah. does, yeah, it goes underneath though.
It goes oh, it does?
Yeah, it goes under
yeah,
Lake River.
I forgot about that. Yeah. It looks like it does, but yeah, it discharges out here.
Okay.
So, better receiving waters.
Uh-huh.
So, the other map actually is actually maps out or has the call outs on the map for the majority of the projects here and kind of tells you what the reason for the project.
For the general facilities projects?
For the general facilities and okay. repair and replacement.
Oh, okay.
It actually has, in the legend there, you can see it has general mm-hmm. facilities, repair and replacement, okay. developer reimbursement, and septic elimination. So this 6-year program is significantly higher than in terms of total projects because of the Ridgefield mm-hmm. stuff where
uh-huh.
we normally wouldn't have whatever the total here is, $100 million worth of projects in a 6-year period, but because of the projects associated with Ridgefield, we're doing 3 big projects, the Discovery Corridor project, as well as a project to get sewer service across from where it exists now. We're at the 45th Avenue, across the freeway over to where the Peace Health, what's known as the Peace Health site.
Mm.
On 65th, so really sure what else there is.
As part of your Discovery Corridor project, is that just one main line you put in there, or are you kind of heading out east and west from there too into areas within the urban growth boundary or that are slated to become part of the urban growth boundary or that are in urban reserve or whatever?
The only point of the only intermediate point of connection is going to be at that 209th Street pump station down at the rest area.
Mm-hmm.
There will be a line stubbed out of the rest area, a gravity line stubbed out of the rest area for future service to basically the 199th to 219th area. We have several other projects on the capital program up in the fairgrounds area that will provide service to that area of the urban growth boundary. But the lines that are being installed with the Discovery Corridor, aside from the gravity lines in Ridgefield, it's all pressure lines that won't have the ability to connect directly into them. So,
because we're not allowed to connect to unserved areas, I mean, we can't serve this outside of the urban growth boundary.
Right, right. But those underserved areas, I guess, would be a way of saying it. In the urban growth boundaries, those are part of your program.
So, yeah. Yeah, they're part of the program. We don't have, at this particular point in time, it was in the 6-year program, we don't have much in the way of capital expenditures north of the fairgrounds along Penn Bab there. That's a pretty wide open corridor, but there's nothing up there at this particular point in time, and we're aside from putting that pump station in at the rest area to give it a place to go to, we're not really planning for any additional capital in that area that would be immediately ready for immediate connection anyways.
But we are trying to serve the Northeast 10th Avenue in coordination with the county and also the Little Creek at the 179th intersection as much as we can until there are so many other
And you guys do this right around the same time that they go through the growth management update.
Yeah.
So that you can see what areas might become part of the UGB, when they're going to be unfolding, how long out they might be before they become developable, and plan for that.
Yeah, and we try to, I mean, that's why this is a rolling 6 years, because we try to keep tabs on where things are going. We're actually in our GIS program, we track all of our like requests for utility review type, all of that stuff is tracked, so we can look at an area and say there's no facilities out here, but there's a lot of people asking about it because we've had a lot of requests for review out in this area. And so we try to use that to help guide where we're going. Does it always work? No, because sometimes things get political in nature and you're jumping through and spending money because somebody talked to somebody else who talked to somebody else, and then it came up and we needed to look at serving an area that's never really been looked at before, but one major player wants to go out there. And you know, if it's somebody who has political pull within the county or somebody who's just possibly going to bring a lot of jobs in, that suddenly puts priority over into a different area. Or if it's, you know, Cabela's or a Bass Pro Shop or something like that, who cares how much it costs to get sewer there? But
some of the questions that you're asking might are answered in a little interesting.
This is really well done. By the way, really,
yeah. That's Heidi's fault. So.
Is it?
Well, darn it, well done, Heidi.
Yeah. Your reasoning down here, your strategic purpose and how this thing comes together, that's really helpful, and I think makes sense. Question, if I may, please.
Sure.
The revenue bonds that you issue from time to time,
mm-hmm.
how are those paid? What's the source of funds? Do you try and target the area of improvement, or is it a general general receipts?
Typically, if it is a project that's funded through our capital facilities plan, it would be general receipts, so connection
district
fees
wide.
Throughout the district
mm-hmm.
go towards paying those bonds back. If it is something that is it's kind of an off-book, more local collection oriented, then it would be an assessment against the area that would be paid back through increased connection fees over that geographic, that specific geographic area.
And the difference in PWTF loans versus revenue bonds is incredible. So we support PWTF.
What's the status of that?
It's still a program, but it's
kind of gone away, isn't
yeah,
it?
Well, it's still a program, but funding is not really there. They're funding it through the revolving piece of it. They're not putting any new capital into it at this point.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Thank you, both of you.
Good work.
Appreciate it.
Nice work.
And it looks like we're...
Right
on schedule.
Yeah.
Well done. I knew we could do it.
Thank you. The next item are the driveway curb cuts. Who's setting that up?
That's Alex. Alex here with us with Diamond Concrete Cutting.
Well, good afternoon, Development Board. Greg.
Thank you.
Thank you for this opportunity to speak to you today. I'm getting a lot of pressure from the building community, home builders specifically, for horizontal curb cutting. Essentially what this is as you know, many of you know, I'm sure you're very aware, and I don't mean to insult your intelligence by reviewing this, but when you put the development in, sometimes they put the driveway drops in, and when the house is built, many times decisions are changed, people flip-flop the house, and then the approach is in the wrong place, you end up having to cut it out and remove it. Ideally, in an ideal world, the approach works out and it's all streamlined. But we've been cutting curbs in Clark County for since 1997, and a lot of times it doesn't work out. anyways, what we're proposing is to cut the approaches in afterwards. Many times, builders are frustrated with having to tear out the curb, so what they do is they pour a solid curb and gutter straight through, or else just a standing curb straight through. And then we'd come in with demo saws, and we'd cut where the approach is going to be. They'd tear out the concrete, and then they'd have someone come in with a backhoe and haul it off, and then the concrete guys form it up on the new approach, and they'd pour it back in. What we have a new machine that's been on the market in other parts of the United States, but this machine is capable of cutting in the approach. So is what you have is if you have a development where there's no existing approaches that were put in during the development, we come in right before they pour the driveway, and we can cut the approach right into the existing curb, and it's exactly where the approach is supposed to be, and you don't have to tear out the streets and you know, mess with the subgrade and open up the street, because we've been doing the old method of tearing off the curbs, and builders get frustrated because anytime you tear out the curb, curb and gutter, and it's even worse when you just have a standing curb with asphalt right up against the curb, mm-hmm. and you tear that out, because then you actually compromise the street more. But what happens many times during the wet weather, you have a lot of water running down the street. As soon as you take that curb out, all that water runs right into the approach, and it softens the subgrade, and it compromises the subgrade. With the method that we're proposing, is we can come in a storm with water running down the street. We can come in, we cut the approach right in, and we leave a lip just like a poured-in-place driveway approach, and the water keeps running by the lot down the street to the drain. This, I see we're getting pressure from builders. We bought the machine in 2010, and a lot of builders, most of the builders in Clark County use this method now, and we called all the time, people hearing that we have this machine, they want to do it this way. The comments are, this is so much nicer, and they don't have the headache and potential liability of having to come back later on down the road and repair the street where they've had settling issues. You have any questions up to this point?
Well, just, it sounds like it's being used. I've done, I don't know if it was you or somebody else, but I've used, you did this, it was on camera.
Yeah, yeah.
It only seems natural that mm-hmm. we would support this, and it would be, I think the request is to become part of the standard detail, one of the standard details. Is that what the request is? And it's not right now.
As an alternative, the county has a standard detail which includes a thickened section. Kind of the thing that we have to, be cautious of here. Say if the curb is just simply made here, and I think Alex's drawing, you could see this here. If the curb is just simply cut.
You don't have the reinforcing underneath it.
Well, we don't have the reinforcing, but I think the concern is sometimes in the field, unless we really specify this, which his drawing does, you know. But up to this point, I don't know that we had this quite so much where it wasn't defined so much. There could be the tendency just to simply take off and pour, you know, the same 6-inch section all the way through the driveway drop into the driveway. And so we just wanted to make sure that we've got a thickened section, which this does. And then I think at least on the county side, because that is a cold joint all the way down along the back side of that existing gutter there, we were asking for a modest amount of additional reinforcement, as in dowels, maybe to the tune of even if it's on center every 3 foot. It's not a heavy structural thing, but just some dowels about eight inches in on either side. And I know we've got Dean here with us. I welcome your input from our construction management crew, but. Just to, give some additional, protection against any kind of differential settlement there.
The dowels, could you just drill them in, pound them in, and they're actually to prevent some differential?
Yes.
Can I speak to that, Greg?
Sure.
I spoke about existing poured-in-place approaches. What we're doing is, instead of pouring them in place in the beginning, we're cutting them in place at the end. and you have the same thicknesses left over and the same structural integrity of the curbs left over as a poured in place approach. And there's nobody in Clark County that's doweling poured in place approaches when they pour the approach behind them. And many times we see because we've been right on the front line and we're doing the cutting, and many times there when the removal happens and the pour back, a lot of times builders aren't even, you know, and that's maybe not the builder, but the concrete contractor are not even thickening up the approach or the curb that they're ripping out replacing. And so I guess I wanted to, that was food for thought. There's no difference as far as structural strength and integrity.
Do you have this detail?
Yes, I do. Okay. Yeah. That's what we're proposing right there. And we're proposing that to line up with the county's standards. Oh,
the only thing you're arguing against is the doweling.
Yeah, because like over Falcon's, I think it's Falcon's Nest.
Yeah.
I mean, that whole development there is poured in place approaches. And
yes,
there, a lot of them line up, and they're not doing any doweling in the driveway approach. And so, I guess, for the sake of consistency, here with this, is
that's what our standard is.
You know, are you going to require downing on poured in place approaches?
So the curb.
Do you understand what you understand where I'm going with this?
With the current canvas.
Are you talking? I apologize. My name is Dean Shattuck. I'm with Public Works Construction Management. I manage the construction inspection sections for Public Works. I've actually coordinated with Ott, I think, in the past, and gave approval for certain driveways off of 88th Street, I think. It was one of the first times I actually saw this take place in person. And it actually works very well in certain situations. You know, there's often times where the original design, for whatever reason, didn't jive with actual construction. And you have a driveway that's going in, and you have a catch basin in front of you. Mm-hmm. And if that catch basin is going to conflict with the driveway, that's a significant problem. You don't want to have to go out and reconfigure the storm and everything else. So we left the curb in place and actually did the vertical cut, excuse me, the horizontal cut, providing the profile for the wings. It turned out really nice. And we were able to stay out of the catch basin. It was a win-win for everybody, and I think it worked out pretty well. And I think in some cases, there probably is justification for doing it. I think on our side, and for just for the interest of the driveway itself, we do have problems regularly getting the increased depth. Because if they go through and they pour the curb and gutter or a standard curb, we're not necessarily getting the extra depth that we're supposed to have for the driveway apron and coming off the area anyway. That's a problem in itself. They can over X on the backside, dig that down. It's a bit of a problem, and oftentimes they don't do that. So we do run into problems there. You get it all ready to go, you got mud on the way, and your concrete guy's only got, you know, he has an over X and he's not pouring. So now you got mud on the way and you got a bigger problem. That happens all the time because the concrete company or the builder is not constructing it appropriately. And it really puts our inspection staff in an awkward position because those guys aren't taking the due diligence on their part to form it up correctly. So if we go to, we have the cold joint issue, and we ran into this with the vertical cuts because there was a period of time where they were coming in and actually trying to do a vertical cut at the face of vertical cut at the face of curb, leaving the gutter portion and actually just removing the curb section. And that left the cold joint at the face of the driveway, and that actually deteriorated pretty quickly. Obviously, the cut's right in the flow line of all of your drainage coming into the gutter. That didn't work very well at all. So we did entertain a few years back the actual horizontal cut to see if that would work. It, on the surface, it seems like it would work pretty well. I think there's some structural issues relative to how that matches in with the curb and to ensure that we get our overall depth, and then also the issue of the exposed aggregate that it leaves along the curb line itself. Because it obviously will wear differently than the gutter and the rest of the concrete in the area.
Yeah, and can I speak to that?
Oh, absolutely.
As far as the exposed aggregate, this method they've been using this in New York, the state of New York, for 30 years. And it's time tested. I mean, they get a lot more extreme weather over there. We've been doing this in Tri-Cities for 20 years, in Texas for 25 years. In Utah, they've been doing this for probably 20, 25 years. The reason why it hasn't been done around here is because the machine is so expensive, and, you know, every contractor doesn't have one sitting in their garage. As far as the structural integrity of the existing curb, this method that we're proposing does not work in every situation. We were called out to a development within the last 2 weeks to cut two curbs in this development, and we inspect the curb before we cut it. And the curb was compromised. And so what we did, instead of doing the horizontal cut, I called the builder right away and said, hey, this ain't going to work. This curb needs to be replaced. And so, you know, I confirmed that with him. We took our demo cut saw and cut the curb for removal and replacement. We found out that the gutter was only 4.5 inches thick. And so this was two houses in the same development. And so what happened, this curb and gutter got compromised during the construction process because, as you know, there's a lot of traffic over that curb.
Right.
We went to another development right after that to cut another approach. And I inspected the curb, and the curb looked great, and we cut the approach. So then what I did is I walked through the whole development to see if I could find one crack, one structural failure in that whole curb section, that whole development. Not one. I couldn't find one. So what I did, I took my tape measure out, and measured the curb, and the gutter in that development was 7 inches thick. And so,
that is one of our concerns, is the continuous depth of the gutter line throughout the development. And if we go across the board with approval for a horizontal cut, we are jeopardizing the actual depth. Because in some situations, if you don't get your depth on the curb, on the gutter line itself, you're going to run into problems.
Yeah, our standard is at, it's a thickened section, it's a 10-inch. So your update here, Alex, I think is actually close to this. You do come in with a thickened section. I mean, if we can get built in the field what you're proposing here, I think we're very close to a viable alternative. The only thing that at least the development engineering side has some concerns with is, unlike the county standard, which is a monolithic pour, this now has a cold joint all the way through the back existing portion of your gutter there. So we were looking to avoid any differential settlement with just some intermittent spacing of some dowels. And I think at least our review of it, we considered it as a viable alternative.
Just on my personal opinion, honestly, I think it is a viable alternative. I don't necessarily think that it should be a standard. And there are going to be cases where it would definitely be very helpful and to have an alternative to go back to and do this approved throughout the county.
Well, it's got to be, this has, see, if we come up to a job and we're actually got a curve, we're not going to cut the thing. The thing should be removed or replaced. Because we inspect it, and when we walk away, our name's on it. And for us, it's very important not to leave the contractor in a better position than a worse position. Because what happens is, after we cut it, it's inspected. If it doesn't pass inspection, it's going to be ripped out. We're going to be called back to cut it again, and the builder's going to pay again. This is a proposal that we're asking to be a viable alternative. It's got to pass our inspection when we drive it to the job site before we even cut the curb. But when we arrive on the job site, the curb has already been, we're the last process before the driveway is poured. And the curb has been tested with all the traffic going over it. If it's still intact, if it still retains its structural integrity, then our viewpoint, and we look for separation from the curb between the curb and the asphalt. We look for structural cracks or settling. If there's none of that, the curb looks great and it's still intact, then we feel it's fine to cut the approach, and the builder will be fine. What we've been asking them to do is, builder's been asking us, since this has come to the table, we've been asking them, you know, to dig out behind underneath the curb like this proposal, so that there is like a toe underneath that's gonna provide additional support, you know, to address that concern.
I think for the most part, what you're talking about right now has been, without approval, official approval process taking place, is pretty much happening on a fairly regular basis when it needs to happen. It's just how to make sure that we have approval for an acceptable alternative and then ensure that you get the structural integrity that we can. So I know this is, it happens fairly regularly now when these types of cases do come up. I just, my concern would just be, and as Greg said, you know, our preference, I think, would be for it to be poured monolithically if we could. If it can't be, or there's a reason why it shouldn't be, then obviously there's an acceptable alternative, and that would be one. And I totally support that.
Well, I'll tell you what, our proposal actually is a lot better. It's a lot stronger than if you have existing port-in-place approaches. If you have existing port-in-place approaches, if they're using that existing port-in-place approach on the curb and they're going to pour the driveway behind it, there is no thickening process that goes on of that curb. With our process, what we're proposing is digging out underneath the backside. You actually thicken that up, and you provide an additional support besides the existing curb there. So this is actually, in our viewpoint, a much better proposal than just the current developments, which is it's approved, where you have port-in-place approaches and they're pouring the gravity behind them. Because there is no thickening of that curb section, and there is no downing that's currently happening and going on.
The thickening is supposed to be there just because they don't do it.
Yeah.
Somewhat of a limitation on the curb machines when they do it. They're pouring, they're kind of laying these curbs down, and it's coming out of a preform. So for them to get that thickened edge, I pulled up the detail of kind of what they have. They basically have standard 6 inches thick at the curb, but then it just kind of goes right where a driveway approaches, it goes to 10 inches. So there's 4 inches additional. With the machine, the limitation on the machine, it's not adding that thickened edge a lot of times. And I don't know if there's a way to do that. I'm not an expert in curb machines, but what I've seen is it kind of comes out in like a shape. It's like a Play-Doh machine.
Mm-hmm. I can tell you for.
I mean, it really is
bringing up another.
There's limitations on the equipment.
Because we're cutting these approaches out, it's not happening. If it's supposed to be happening, it hasn't been happening. It hasn't been happening since 1997 when we've been here. From 97 to today, it hasn't happened. We haven't seen it.
I know it does happen because I've been on the job where we start and stop with the curb machine, and specifically for that reason. And we've also had situations on jobs where we had the drop put in as they went through and had them remove that because it wasn't deep enough. I'm not saying it doesn't happen. I just know that there is an effort to ensure that we do get that thickened edge. Is it happening 100% of the time? Maybe not, but I can help you with that to ensure that it does.
I'm being honest. Haven't seen it, but
that's something we can address internally on our side to ensure that that is happening.
I think we're going to need to wrap this up, this discussion up. Where were we looking to have this go? Were you guys going to work with staff internally to see if this is an alternative, maybe come up with a standard detail as an alternative, publication? What's been the thinking on this? Because I haven't been part of the discussion, but I know that you guys have.
Where do we stand right now? So
I think with staff, we consider it, this came to us shortly. We met with Alex and a few other builders, developers. Within a few days after that, he provided this. We've reviewed it. We got back and basically considered this proposal as a viable alternative with the note that we asked that there also be some intermediate valves that were placed, in connection with the construction, basically embedded 8 inches on each side, three feet on center, and then we were good with it.
So one other piece of information, just kind of looking at and requiring an 8-inch thick, concrete section at an approach, that's fairly unconventional. If you look across different jurisdictions in residential areas, it's fairly conventional for a commercial approach where you have heavy truck traffic. There's a significant difference.
Where do you
difference.
Get this 8-inch? At the very bottom?
No, you're not looking at here. Oh. That's not the county's detail.
I think it's actually 10, isn't it?
No, I'm sorry. 10 inches, you're right. Okay. So the county requires 10 inches of concrete at a gutter right now. Most of the time, 6 inches of thickened section, 4 inch on sidewalks, and it goes to 6 inches when it's thickened, when there's truck traffic that could go over. So another thing to look at would be, is that the county has one detail for residential and commercial approaches. They both require that. It almost seems like a little overkill in a residential. When you look at an axle loading and a loading on a truck traffic versus a standard, just a regular car, it's 20,000, I pulled it up earlier, it was 3,000 times more damage for one truck axle versus a car axle. So there's probably a difference between a residential driveway approach and a commercial driveway approach. So doing the thickened edge on a commercial approach and the valves make a lot of sense. On residential, most people, they go with a 6-inch curb, or most jurisdictions, and they cut it down, and they don't worry about thickening it for residential. Well, really, what you get is shrinkage cracks more than damage from anything else.
It sounds like we're getting into some details that are beyond kind of the rest of the board's review. Do you want to work directly with staff then to see if they, you guys can come up with a reasonable alternative that is agreeable to not only the your industry inspection, but the building industry as well? It sounds to me like that's the next step here. We could discuss the merits one way or the other all day around this table, but not anywhere.
I mentioned this issue to Dallin, and the builder, I was like, whoa, I mean, build, no way. I mean, you know, the question is why. They don't see any reason why to do it. And so part of what I'm saying about not doing Dowling is I'm here also representing the building community, you know. And if it was proven that, you know, it certainly needs to be done, then I think they would probably entertain the thought. But
so could I just suggest, this is really well done, Alex. It really is. I think we've heard quite a bit, heard a lot.
Absolutely.
We take it under advisement. Mm-hmm. Maybe provide some feedback, and off we go.
And maybe
I can pull together a
subcommittee.
I can pull together that, Eric. If you would like to assist us there, I'll get Dean, Ali, Alex, and I think the five of us get together.
Perfect.
I mean, if anybody else would like to participate, let me know. And yeah, we'll pull together this month.
Marty? He said count me out.
Okay. So they can go up.
Where are we? So what's happening on the ground right now? I think we were one of the first ones to run into this.
What would it be, Jeff?
What's that? Well, because the county had an existing policy, but cutting was going on, and all of a sudden someone decided to, or whatever, the existing policy came out of the woodwork and started getting applied, and all of a sudden curb cutting wasn't being allowed. So what's being allowed today? Because it is very difficult, especially on large subdivisions, to put your driveway drops. You know, you don't know whether it's garage right, garage left, center, whatever, you know, so... Yeah. I guess what's happening today? Like, are you being allowed to cut? Because I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, I know Ali's taken a couple of calls on that, and we do have an intermediate plan. So do you want to help us out?
Yeah, actually, on the ongoing project, we still allow it, but we would like to film this up and have a standard and go with it as soon as possible.
So the ongoing is kind of, we're still allowing
it. Allowing it. Because it's the building inspectors that see
Type of. Perfect, thank you, that's good.
Now that I complicated it, maybe we can simplify it. This here, I mean, I really think this is a good design. I would make a motion that we accept this and require Dowling on commercial approaches and not on residential.
I'll second.
I think that would simplify this whole thing, because I think that's, load-wise, I think the dowels may be justified in a commercial approach. The joint, the amount of weight on them in a residential approach.
Discussion.
Okay.
Yes.
We've got discussion.
So,
yep. We've got a motion and a second.
Mm-hmm. I really like this. I think the county's having a little bit of heartburn over the dowling. And here's the reason that I'm going to, Alex. These machines are expensive. And for 50 cents worth of dowel and 20 minutes worth of effort and a $100 battery powered drill, you can make the county happy. Not everybody is as conscientious as you are. There's going to be guys that are going to get into this, and they're going to look at this detail and say, wow, easy, slam dunk. Dean's going to walk out there and say, gee, you should really dowel this. No, don't have to. It's not in the detail. I think this is a huge win for you. And I think you should take it. You should say doweling fine. I dowel all my stuff, especially if you're allowed just to drill the hole out, pound the bar in. Holy cow, that's a no-brainer. If you talk about epoxy or some special testing, that's not what they're asking for. I think this is a huge win. We ought to take it. So I know there's a motion on the table. I'm going to advocate for the dowling. And you're going to win.
That's part of it.
Because you're going to do it right. So, dowling commercial, I'm suggesting also residential. There is an issue.
Is that part of your motion,
Eric? How do you feel about that? Because I would rather avoid a bunch of work groups for something that's really a simple issue. I think we can solve this today.
Okay. So. There is going to be this issue.
Yeah.
I deal with it quite a bit. Dean's seen it. He's helped solve some of it for us.
What is the cost of dowel? I don't know. I
mean, what do you think? You're the one that
we're talking six or eight bars that are 16 inches long. 50 cents worth of bar and 45 minutes worth of labor.
It's an extra cost for the builder that hasn't been justified in the builder's mind. And I'm talking about builders that builders of integrity. I work for some builders that, you know, I mean, I sometimes feel like my standards are higher than theirs, you know. But I don't believe any of those are sitting in this room. So I end up being kind of accountability for them. However, what I'm talking about the builders that have their integrity, you know, we have here.
Alex,
those are the ones that are.
Alex, with all due respect, we have a motion on the table with discussion with the board itself. So my apologies. That's quite all right. So we have a motion on the table. We have a second. Any more discussion with the board?
What is the motion?
Dallying on commercial.
Yeah.
Okay.
That is your motion.
And adopting that.
The one thing I do want to bring up is that the second join in, when you look at the county detail, is not dialed in at 6 inches to 6 inch. So between the driveway approach, from the curb to the driveway approach, then it goes to the sidewalk, okay. And it's a 6 inches to 6 inches.
And this is simply a recommendation by the board to Public Works to work on this workout. So we have a motion on the table for the detail with dialing only on commercial. We have a second on that. Any more discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed?
Aye.
Okay.
Simply because on the record, I want to add it to the residential requirement.
Any abstentions?
I abstain because I didn't hear the discussion.
Okay. Two ayes, two nays, two abstentions, and I don't know enough about it, so I too will abstain.
Should we go with the next motion then?
Nice work.
With the dollar sign.
Yeah, okay. So I will, if I may, make a motion.
Absolutely.
That we adopt this as a suggested alternative for the county to consider. We recommend that they adopt it with the dowling for both commercial and residential applications.
Okay.
So,
do I have a second?
I second.
Okay. Yeah, any discussion? None seen. All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
All
right. Okay. 3-4. Very good. All right. This is done and done.
Big deal. This will be good for you.
And I too will abstain because I still don't know enough about it. Did you catch that?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay.
All right.
I'm like listening to it later though.
All right. Last item is the final site plan review process update from Diana.
You have 3 minutes, Diana.
I can talk fast. After talking with Eric and Mike, they had three main issues: is the timing of the FSR submittal, the approval of the FSR, and when documents need to be submitted. The FSR should be submitted at the same time as the final engineering plan.
Mm-hmm.
The FSR has to be approved prior to the final engineering plans being approved. Documents depend on when the conditions require them. Unfortunately, that's out of our control. So it's whenever the conditions could be in A. If it's in A, they need to be prior to final engineering plans, prior to final site plan approval. And then it can be in other places, which would be required at different other times. The only thing that we look at is before we get provisional acceptance, we need to make sure all the documents, everything is submitted prior to, so that is our only control hammer that we can use to ensure that everything is done. Otherwise, if it's shoved off for occupancy, a lot of people move in and we have no way of getting that document unless we have a way of controlling.
Well, you're talking about final site plan.
Correct.
Yeah, final site plan.
And it's not tied to occupancy.
The documents that she's referring to, this was precipitated by the fact that prior to final site plan approval, they have to have all of the legal descriptions written for easements and for
covenants,
stormwater facilities, all of these items that happen in advance of any construction taking place. We all know that during construction, things move, things relocate, things change sizes, and therefore now we've got easements written for a sewer line or a water line where it might not be actually constructed. The stormwater facility may have changed size, location even. And to release covenants, I believe it takes an act of the board.
Yes.
So, so what we're what you're doing and what I hear what you're saying is that we're going to keep it status quo.
Well, we can only go by what was in the hearing report. If the document's required in the A condition, it has to be done at the A condition.
Okay.
Which means prior to final engineering approval and final site plan approval.
Okay. Who drives that process, though?
The hearing report.
I understand
well,
that,
it's
but
staff report.
Yeah, staff report.
It's staff.
Kind of that's
right.
Yeah.
Here's what the condition doesn't say, though. It doesn't say that it says prior to final engineering and final site plan. Those two really are two different processes. That would be if all the conditions say prior to final plat and final engineering. And residential, they don't do it that way because the final plat is usually done at the end before they start building homes. You start construction. While you're doing construction, you're working on the final plat. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, you mm-hmm. as-built and then final plat. On site plan, you're front-loading everything. You're asking for right-of-way dedications,
yep.
easements, covenants, mm-hmm. all these things that really are out of place.
Because nothing gets recorded like it does with the plat. You have the plat that gets recorded, so you've got that. With the site plan, nothing gets recorded. So the only stopping point that we have is provisional acceptance, or if the conditions are in A conditions.
And
A conditions is prior to final.
Is there a downside to having it prior to provisional acceptance or to occupancy?
Occupancy, no. We have no way, because they're going to move in.
You don't want people moving in and having a bunch of outstanding issues.
We won't get anything. Trouble getting as built, so we have trouble getting all of our documents if they've already moved into the building. We have no hammer.
Okay.
Well, how do you get as built on commercial properties?
At provisional acceptance, we have to have that before.
So then we move all those things to provisional acceptance.
Yeah.
Okay, but now what I'm hearing is that it depends on where they're at in the staff report. So this needs to trickle down to the people that write the staff reports and put those conditions in there to put them to provisional acceptance rather than prior to final site and engineering approval.
So that's great on new ones. We can do that from now on. But then there's those old ones that They just
glump all together. They're going to say there's nothing we can do unless we go back through a post-decision review to get those changed.
Or, if it's real simple, Marty can make the decision maybe.
Let's just go forward with it.
I said maybe.
Can I ask a question?
Uh-huh.
I don't think it is a staff's decision or a policy. You might want to check the code to make mm-hmm. sure there is nothing in the code that says the site plan shall be approved with construction plan.
Or that easements be recorded and covenants be done before.
It's worthwhile to check the code mm-hmm. because I don't think the staff has decided to ask for this on a certain time. I'm sure there is something in the background. I don't know enough about the planning code to say,
mm-hmm.
but it's worthwhile to check. If we need to change the code, we should.
Take a look at the site plan review, take a look at it.
No.
Those stuff, site plan review, unless you're talking something that's associated with a CUP, it's not gone to a hearings examiner.
Right.
It's staff, and
mm-hmm.
we've issued a decision with conditions. I'm willing to entertain
changes,
but I need to make sure that we're not running afoul of the code, nor will we get into practical difficulties down the road.
And we don't want that either. That's not the intention. The intention is to avoid issues down the road with changes to covenants and easements and everything else, which has happened. We've tried that before. We get a draft staff report and we say, hey, we want to push all this stuff off to occupancy or provisional acceptance or somewhere other than right at this time. Yeah. Nope, that's our policy. That's when you need it, and that's why we're talking about it today.
And I also want to see how many projects are in the queue that we're looking at.
Okay, that'll be fine. So,
this is an issue that we ran into on the apartment project.
It was a big deal.
Diane,
maybe we can talk.
And I'm okay with you. Let's just go forward with it. Let's adopt it, move forward.
If there's certain things that are popping up, I keep hearing easements and covenants, and mm-hmm. I don't know enough about the covenants part because we don't deal in those. But with easements, something about recording an easement before you build the facility that's supposed to be in it seems
a
little
exactly. You understand? That is it.
That seems like it's something you can pick the cherry pick the things that are causing the problems and try and work out.
So Diana, you'll check the code then, see if there's anything in there, and then maybe come back to us real briefly in May. And
if it is a policy that's not as tied to the code, I mean, policies can be revisited.
Because that's exactly the way the city of Vancouver runs it. Provisional acceptance. I mean, they've got it on a little chart that says you got to have this all done.
Yeah.
Maybe having that, whatever they have, maybe.
I'll let you copy that.
Okay.
That's fine.
Okay, we've got, on time. Diana, thank you. I appreciate that. We all do. Any public comment? Alex, here's your time. Here's your chance.
Go take some heat from the builder now.
Okay, seeing none, we're adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.
And then Commissioner Stewart's farewell is next.
You're welcome.
Pretty packed meeting.
And I heard the first hour of social, and at 4 o'clock the presentation
started.
I checked.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah.
Actually, so we're just doing good old.